2, 1. All right, welcome to our next very, very important episode of Sorry No Budget. The topic for today is
future proofing international enrollment management.
And I know the question is, you know, what does that have to do with having a no budget? Well, of course, it does have everything to do with, having or not having a budget as an educational institution. Because if we do not future-proof international education management, if we are not the number one place where all international students want to come for their experience, guess what happens to our budgets?
What budget?
Yeah, I know, right? Oh, man. So here's what I'm thinking. You know, it's such a big topic, right? It's such a heavy topic. So do we want to take a stab at defining it first?
I mean, yeah, we could probably take a stab at defining it. You know, future, you could define that any point in time in the future. Are we talking future proofing? Are we proofing it for the next, 6 months or the next 10 years type thing, right? So future proofing in international enrollment management. This is important for institutions that want to be around for the long haul. And it's important for individuals who are trying to make an impact immediately in their career. Maybe they're only here for 6 months or a year and they're trying to figure out how do you future-proof. So how do you define in your role future-proofing? And then how do you define international enrollment management?
In my role, I'll start with the second part of it. How do I define international enrollment management? One, I look at it as, growing the number of international students that go through our institution, whether it's, full-time students, whether it's exchanges, even online, there's now everything is, with the advance of technology, making those classes available online, and students actually can take them from their home country. They don't have to be here. On another level, also faculty, right? Being able to, as an institution, exchange ideas, our faculty with faculty from, various countries and cultures. If I were at a much bigger university, I'd probably add in school/country partnerships, right? So, for example, utilizing the research power, the brain power of one institution to help another country with some of their immediate needs, whether it's health needs, whether it's, global warming, things like that. So it's a broad scope, right? But this is that the second part. The first part of it, which you asked me, was, future-proofing, right? So future-proofing to me, I think of it more as long-term, right? Not like for the next 6 months. I think of it, competitively for the foreseeable future. I mean, you touched on a very good point, and I'm thinking we're going to touch on it, demographics. So the U.S. demographics and most of the developed world, is just shrinking. There's less students now every year graduating from high school, and a lot of these state institutions, what do they do now? They either have to shut down or they have to look for new sources students, to keep their budgets going.
Yeah. So that future proofing, I mean, I agree. You're not talking about proofing something for the next 6 months. That 6 months is more of like the individual that's wanting right. to contribute, right. right? But the future proofing is for the institution to have a system. I like that you incorporated faculty into that international enrollment management, alumni into that international enrollment management, things that are tangential maybe to the application and the enrollment, but that are impactful to the longevity of internationalization at that campus, in those programs, and in the community around the campus. All of that plays a role into future proofing, right?
Yeah.
I think about future proofing, and I think about wanting to be known for something to where it's almost passive, like sorry, no budget. Passive income is like a big thing people talk about, right? You can't rely on IEM being passive. Like you can't do that unless you're a name that has been able to do that for so long. a named institution. But your reaction there when I said that was...
I like that, because you know what? I didn't even think about that. Shame on me that I didn't think about that, but go ahead.
No, your reaction was visceral, man. When I said that, I want to like get into that a little bit, but there are institutions that when I was in Singapore and Hong Kong, there are institutions that would come once every 3 years, and that's all they would do, because they had created a system, whether that be brand, whether that be alumni. They'd created a system where they only needed to travel and do something every now and then. Well, not everybody's in the luxury of doing that.
Yeah.
And is future-proofing getting to that point? I don't know.
You know what happened when you said that, when you started out kind of giving your definition of future-proofing for even like the short term? It's just like my mind just, it's the brand, stupid. And the funny thing is, because, you know, shame on me, right? That's why I said shame on me, because like I shouldn't use this as a venue for me. It shouldn't be the place for me to go, wow. I think of international education management so much at like the top policy level that you know, sometimes you lose sight of the fact that, yeah, if you have a strong brand, who cares what happens? People will always come to you, right? So like if you're Harvard and you only accept 1% of your total applicants, who cares what happened to the US, if it falls behind or if it's this or that, you know, as long as you maintain your brand and your quality of education and people want to come to you, you've already future-proofed it. Oh man. I mean, this is done. This is the end of the podcast. We solved it. We'll see you again on the next episode.
Branding's good, and Harvard's a great example of one that doesn't travel to grow their applications because they don't need it. But you know, there's Franklin and Marshall, and you know, Franklin and Marshall's a great college in Lancaster, PA. A lovely school. Kids all around Asia wear Franklin and Marshall sweatshirts.
Yeah.
But that's not because of Franklin and Marshall College. It's just Franklin and Marshall happens to have another brand, right? But I would not. I could talk to their guy who I know at in the international enrollment, and they haven't capitalized on the branding of Franklin and Marshall, right? I mean, they have a little bit for sure. People search up Franklin and Marshall a little bit, and it's right. A known name because of that brand. Yeah. But branding's a huge part of future-proofing. But how do you future-proof when you don't yet have an established group that loves you, that needs you, that feels that they need you?
So a lot of it is just awareness, just building awareness, right? At you know, at a smaller institution level, you want to make sure that your brand gets in front of as many people as possible. And a lot of the future proofing actually has to be done kind of at the engagement level. So rather than just focusing on inspirational messages and trying to, you know, build kind of like a pipeline, you know, for 3 to 5 years down the road, you work on advertising that activates those students, those prospective students mm-hmm. that are ready to come in now. As you keep doing that and you get better at that, and, you know, obviously your resources continue to grow, then it gives you a little bit more time to start doing some brand activation exercises, you know, so that you can build a pipeline with students that, you know, are now maybe freshmen in high school and they're not even thinking about you, but you're in front of them constantly, whether it is through high school counselors, whether it is through kind of these high touch environments, right? Like school counselors, agents,
T-shirts, if you will,
fairs, those are these high school fairs in various different countries. Yeah, so that's how you do it, yeah. I mean, what have you seen that has been executed very, very well? Because you also have that counselor background, so you get to look at and you get to compare.
I think when I think about future-proofing international enrollment management from a university, right? Like, we're not talking about like making sure students know about educational opportunities. That's something, that's a counselor side, that's a global situation, right? Like, is higher education important? That's not just a university and a college that needs to harp on that. That's businesses, the government needs to be involved, schools need to be involved, the approach of education. So that's like future-proofing, very macro, not that you can control. But for when you think about, like, when you ask me the question, who does it well? I think about it from those that are actively engaging, right? Being there all the time. The schools that would constantly be in person, in the flesh, if you will, in the flesh.
Yeah,
They are there. That builds credibility. That authenticity is important. And so that's future-proofing, because you're building a brand and awareness and something in the student's mind. But when I think about it from like even just a different business standpoint, like a university wanting to be, you know, future-proofed, and ideally what that means is having enough students so that we can continue to educate and employ, right?
Yeah.
I think it's all about the ambition of scalability. A university, I mean, Harvard's a great example. They don't have to get huge at the undergraduate or graduate level. You mentioned hybrid. You can go online and scale so much. The online accessibility makes it challenging to future-proof the in-person classroom. Because if I can go online X, why would I go in person at B? There's that as well. But I think where I see it not go well is universities or colleges that want to grow because they see an opportunity to grow. And I don't think that's the recipe for future-proofing. I think that's the recipe for short-term excitement, but maybe not long-term stability.
I mean, why can't you do a hybrid of both, right? Like, at the end of the day, you know, schools are acting more like businesses, you know, going where the customer is now, right? It's not anymore, well, we're in Eastern Tennessee, so we only, you know, target the Eastern Tennessee markets, you know, in these areas, right? But you have to go out there, and if you can get students from Montana, get students from Montana. I mean, like, I was looking at, you know, the Midwest, the northern part of the Midwest is having a terrible, you know, like from a demographic standpoint, like all their state institutions, you know, some are closing down. They've seen like dramatic decrease in enrollments of local students, right? So they have to go out there and find these new markets, right? So they have to kind of do some of that, you know, short-term thinking, you know, but with the goal of using that as a platform for continued, you know, for continued growth. Having, you know, being able to do that, you know, and especially like if you're a state institution where the budgets have also been cut, right? Like your state budget is continuously being cut, then you have to be opportunistic, you know, in order for you to survive.
Yeah.
And
that's almost why future proofing is important, right? Is survival.
Yeah. But you know, one thing that I worry about when it comes to future proofing is that we're all competing, but we're competing in this, you know, cauldron, if you will, that is just not able to sustain this competition. What I mean by that is we're, you know, the U.S. has an insane amount of higher education institution. We've relied on the fact that still students want to come to the U.S. However, I feel like we're lagging so behind, you know, from other countries, like, you know, whether it's Canada, whether it's Australia, I mean, even United Kingdom, even France now, you know, they just updated their work permit laws for specifically for Indian students, right? But that we're falling so behind that it's going to be hard for a lot of these institutions, even if they build the brand and even if they try to future-proof themselves as much as possible, there's going to be a limit in the number of students they'll be able to attract. I mean, we used to, I remember, maybe you know this number better than I do, but we used to have roughly about 20, or somewhere between 20 and 25% of the entire international student population used to come to the US. Now we're like at 50%. And that number is continuing to grow, but we're continuing to decline.
Yes. I've brought that up a lot, actually, as a reason. Sorry to cut you off there.
I
brought that exact thing up as a reason why when people say the U.S. is a growth market because they have so much, I can see their argument. But it hasn't been a growth market, even when our overall numbers have gone up.
Yeah,
and the cauldron that you speak of, for me, it's basic economics. Supply and demand is a real thing. And in this case, there's only so many students. That when you think about the amount of money to go to the United States, I mean, you can go to a school in Costa Rica. I have a school in Costa Rica that I'm talking to. You can get a full degree, all in English, in San Jose, Costa Rica, for the price of 1 year at a state university.
Yeah.
No, and so what's going to draw people to the United States to future-proof it? You have to have something more than just a brand. You have to have something more than that because it's so expensive. And when at the end of the day, the return on investment that and everybody else, and it comes to the national policy that, I mean, essentially you're talking about a national policy that the US doesn't have either. The France opening up work opportunities, Canada removing all restrictions on international students that can work. Not only can they come in and work and essentially earn their tuition dollars while they study, then they have the PGWP and they can continue on working. We just don't have that same flexibility. So the people that the U.S. wants to come in, whether they'll say it or not from a policy point of view, is the people who already have money.
But
that's the people who already have money think about return on investment and they see other opportunities.
Absolutely.
And the U.S. no longer is the end all be all when it comes to international education. And the numbers are dwindling in terms of the percentage of all international students.
Yeah. You know what drives me crazy? The credit hour system that we have, you know, so like think about it, you know, there's a decision was made, you know, that you need 120 credits to have a bachelor's, you know, diploma. So now we have students coming from countries where, you know, if you were to do the conversion, it's not 120, but it's less than 120, maybe 90, you know, whatever it is. So they're coming in to do a master's here. They've gone through the process, the commitment, everything else. And we're like, yeah, sorry, you just don't meet the requirements for a bachelor's degree in the US because of this credit hour system. So now you're going to have to actually do an additional year of bachelor studies or 2 years or whatever, one semester before you can actually do a master's. I mean, it's like, wait, like, hold on a second. You know, you look back and you're like, this stuff was developed, you know, over 130 years ago, right? Like 130 years ago, you know, like in the late 1800s, they decided 120 credits was supposed to be the equivalent for a bachelor's degree. Here we are, you know, at the age of iPhones and, you know, Zoom and whatever, and we're still kind of like relying on that. I had to go through it myself as a student here coming in on my junior year of high school. And because of the credit system, even though I had more physics, more biology, you know, in terms of content, I was way ahead of people at you know, like a junior year in high school. I still had to do an additional year of high school. So I was in high school for 5 years because all of that 3 years of biology based on the content system accounted only for like a quarter credit or something like that, you know? So I'm sitting in classes that I had already completed years ago, you know, but I had to do them. And even though my professors, for example, would insist on me trying maybe move it to an AP class or something, like that, nope, the system says this, so I, and for me, it didn't cost anything, right? But if you're an international student, that's an additional years of living expenses, of tuition, or whatever that you didn't plan on. So that to me just, needs to be just
So
thrown out the window or reevaluated.
gee, I dealt with that as a counselor all the time. Students coming in with integrated, right? Like they had done in every class starting in as a 13-year-old, every class had a little bit of biology, a little bit of chemistry, a little bit of
Exactly.
physics, right? And then the next year, it was a little bit of all of that at a deeper level. And so when they would
Correct.
transfer into an American system where we do biology, they'd be like, I already know all this. And for the first month, they're right. They knew it all. But the US approach was like, we're going to go really deep in biology. And then the next year, we're going to go really deep in chemistry. And so after a little while, the integrated
Kind of
approach
evens
was like,
out.
it evens out in the end. It is a, it's a totally philosophical difference, right? Like it evens out if you think students will take everything they did in biology and remember it for the next year when they do chemistry. Versus the
Yeah,
integrated
makes sense.
approaches, you're approaching all of it there. As a social studies teacher, we would do it chronologically or thematically. Do you teach from, Mesopotamia all the way up to current day timeline? Or do you say, hey, we're going to talk about wars and we're going to talk about wars, da 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 da. We're going to talk about economy and we're going to talk about economy across the ages. And so it's thematic versus chronological in sciences and math. It's integrated, not. But the question I would have with that is the credit system, while not perfect, what would you replace it with?
No, I mean, I'm not saying abolish it completely. I mean, I'm not Vivek Ramaswamy here, but
Hey, if you have some good rationale for abolishing it, just
I'm joking, but I was
is this
just
your
kind
are
of
you announcing
joking
your
on.
candidacy? You
No,
can't,
no.
you
Well,
can't, you
yes,
can't.
here, this audience of, three directors of admission will propel me to the national stage. No, it was a joke, because every time he has Vivek Ramaswamy on the Department of Education, he wants to abolish it. And I don't know what goes in, what goes in its place. But so do I say abolish it? Absolutely not. I mean, you need a way to, you need some type of a parity method, right? But is it, if let's say a student in India, right? Because this is kind of the case. Some is like, depending on the region, they come in with nine, with what's like the equivalent of 90 credits. If they're coming in, they already finished their bachelor degree. Why wouldn't you take it at face value their bachelor degree is finished, right? I mean, because at the end of the day, they're moving on to their master's, and for STEM master programs, their bachelor degree is actually 4 years, so it's 120. But if you're going to liberal arts, right, it's 90 degrees. So, I think it kind of, so there's a method to it, and I'm sure there's a way to look into this. Because I mean, we're using a system that was developed, like I said, back in Carnegie's time, and it was developed for high schools, not necessarily for colleges. And then they took that and kind of said, let's do this for colleges as well. So I think it needs a little bit of revision. Another area that definitely needs revision, and this is something that I'm sure you and I agree on, it's like this idea of STEM, like STEM classes. It's so funny, because when you look at the recent Open Doors data, I mean, you read kind of like the messages that the analysts and the researchers put in over there, and it's like, oh, the highest growth amount is on STEM. See, everybody wants to study STEM. And I'm like, maybe, and I'm sure, yes, but there's a 3 year carrot that hangs on the STEM, and there's only a 1 year OPT carrot that hangs on the rest of it. Now, if I were coming here, and to your point, I want a return on my investment, of course I'm going to go where I get 3 years of work experience, because that's a better return on my investment than this other one that's only 1 year, right? The non-STEM classes. So like, why have it? Like, what's the benefit of giving somebody 3 years just because they took STEM classes and this one didn't? Just do away with them, Like, give everybody 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, whatever the number is.
I had the same conversation with my friend Emily on Headlines Unleashed. I don't know if you saw that one. I threw it out on YouTube, Headlines Unleashed, and she brought forward to me the OPT was not going to be reviewed by the Supreme Court. And I said, and I'll repeat myself here. I'm not running for president, but I could because I'm a naturally born US citizen, so I could. If I was taking this approach, everything would have an additional 3 years OPT. You study philosophy, extra 3 years. OPT, open it up because you're right. The 3 year carrot is driving students to different things. Now, there's also more job opportunity and more financial
Of course,
security
of
if you go
course.
technology. But you know what? We need a lot of people to start thinking more philosophically about things. And we need people to understand history more. And history is never going to
Yeah.
have STEM clarification. It's never going to have the additional years. And it's never, you're not paying your history teachers a ton of money, right?
Yeah.
However, that thinking and the liberal arts approach that the United States is known for is so valuable for humanity to drive things, to make decisions through wisdom. And those should also have 3 years of OPT. So I'd say
Yeah.
open it up. Open it up to everybody.
Yeah. I mean, even from a demographic perspective, right? You're gonna have millions of jobs that still will remain unfilled unless you bring in international students who graduate from here and have that knowledge here. So just keep them here, like have them have them kind of take over those jobs. And there was also one I read a story of this Turkish guy. Which was pretty interesting. So I don't know if you look into like the G5 technology, like how Huawei, the Chinese company is kind of like the leader now
Yeah.
5G or not G5, 5G. So there's a really kind of funny background
You said
story about
G5, and I was thinking about so fly like a G6, right? I was thinking about the airplanes
yeah,
real quick.
exactly.
Sorry. No. So sorry,
So
the
5G, the
5G, yeah,
5G.
5G. Yeah.
So apparently there was a Turkish student who actually came here and studied in the US, so like some top university, technology. And then he applied for an H-1B visa. He didn't get it. Or he tried to get employment, whatever, couldn't get the employment, because there's no pathway here to kind of maintain some of these like brightest students, they returned him to his country. Okay, when he was here as a student, he basically wrote like the foundation paper on G5, or 5G, 5G technology. So like the Chinese kind of realized that and started funding him in Turkey for their programs. So now Huawei owns like I don't know, 50, 60% of the 5G patents, because it's all built on his work. So like you have this guy here,
That's future proofing. That is future
I mean,
proofing.
right? Like you, but then you're like, yeah, sorry, you don't, like whatever the requirements that we have, you're not good enough here. So like, we'll send you somewhere else, and they'll take care of you. And they do, It's like, yeah, but think of how many stories are like this, right? Think of like how many people, when you take like in Canada, this never happens. Why? Because there's states in Canada, there's regions like, bro, just come in here, forget the requirements. Just come and live here and work here with your Canadian degree and raise a family here and do whatever you need to do here.
I've kind of wondered that with, you mentioned the Midwest earlier. Why not just start opening it up just like we did, in the Lewis and Clark days? Go west, right? And they open it up. Hey, Midwest, you've got acres of farmland that maybe
Well.
people aren't farm. Open it up, build communities, make them international like groups. I don't know.
I mean, this is your opportunity to run. This is your platform right here.
This is my platform. Yeah.
Yeah, there's the make the Midwest great again.
Hey. Absolutely. Let the Midwest draw all people in for all delicious foods of all cultures. It used to, it
Listen.
used to be known as the breadbasket. Now let's make it a smorgasbord of internationalization. That's the Midwest.
So I'm sure you're closer to the Midwest than I am, but I've also lived there and graduated from there, and it's amazing how multicultural and multi-ethnic the Midwest is, and even more accepting of newcomers.
I 100%, 100% agree.
I think it's
I had students that were like, "Oh, I can't go to the Midwest. They don't like, they don't like my kind," type thing. Wrong, wrong. You go to the Midwest. I went to a university in Idaho. If you came in as an international student at my school, you would have had every religion, every person. We did actually. I had a 6'10" Muslim Turkish man on the basketball team. All we did was want to learn about his culture. We wanted to learn about his religion. Everybody did. They invited him over for dinner. How do you cook this food in your country? That's what people in the United States do want, but you have to expose them to opportunities like this. And so it's a little bit of a fear factor. So I guess future proofing is, you mentioned it a little bit, like branding, awareness, building awareness. We have to build awareness within your community for why it would be welcoming and why you should grow more. We're pretty much out of time. I just think future proofing is only possible through experience.
And on that note, on the Midwest, if you want amazing ethnic food, Louisville, Kentucky.
Louisville.
Yeah, Louisville's got it. I mean, whatever. You want a Cuba community, you've got a really big one there. You want a Bosnian community, a huge one there. I mean, you name a country and there's a huge community there with amazing food.
So what would be fun is a big warehouse with all the different cultures having their own take on the bourbon in Louisville. Like, grow some bourbon and add it, like an Albanian.